Welcome to Catch a Mac Science. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. Once a month on Saturday from 11 a.m. to noon, Catch a Mac Science will provide a platform for discussion, inquiry, and peer review of local science. This month, Kyra Wagner crosses disciplines and plots strategy and data points to organize for local food production and distribution on the Kenai Peninsula. Last month, you were invited to a beluga whale count. Today, you'll hear about that count from marine biologists for NOAA Fisheries and Kachemak Bay Campus of Kenai Peninsula College. And we'll talk landslides and expeditions with Brettwood Higman and Bjorn Olson. To introduce Higman, imagine a wave as tall as the ConocoPhillips building in downtown Anchorage. It happened just 3 years ago in southeast Alaska. A new scientific paper makes the case that climate change could increase the likelihood of these events. Nat Herz from Alaska Energy Desk has the story on what a crew of scientists learned when they descended on the fjord where the tsunami happened.
Three years ago, Brettwood Higman heard about a tsunami set off by a landslide. It was so far away from civilization that it was only detected by Columbia University scientists using earthquake monitors. Higman lives with his family in a yurt in Seldovia. He has a PhD in geology, and he's fascinated by tsunamis in the landscape of southeast Alaska. So he started scheming about how he could go take a look.
Sort of dirtbag style, like find, you know, $3,000, $4,000, enough, which, you know, logistics are expensive there, but that'd be enough to get a plane out there, drop me off with my pack raft, go paddle around, dig holes, collect some sand and gravel, and then, you know, I'd figure out what to do next at that point.
The tsunami happened in a place called Tanfjord. The nearest town is Yakutat, population 600, about 60 miles away. And Yakutat itself is way out there. Juneau is another 200 miles to the southeast. Higman figured he should call the two Columbia scientists who first noticed the tsunami. It turned out they were organizing their own expedition and wanted help with logistics from Higman, who's adventured all over Alaska with his wife, author Erin McKittrick. With money from the National Science Foundation, a team of scientists converged on the fjord two summers ago. One of them was Peter Heusler, an Anchorage geologist who motored across the Gulf of Alaska on the Alaskan Gyre, a fishing boat turned research vessel.
So it's about a 50-foot converted seiner.
When Heusler got to the fjord, he could see the aftermath of the tsunami. It happened after a gigantic landslide crashed into the water at the toe of the Tyndall Glacier. It sloshed as high as 600 feet above sea level. Heusler says the first thing he noticed is what's called a trim line.
All of the forest that you would normally expect to find up on the mountainside is gone. It's just wiped clean. You're coming in and it's like, I mean, it's just clear there were giant waves on each side of the bay. You definitely think, boy, I'm glad I wasn't here when this was happening.
Some of the scientists looked at the landslide deposits left on shore. One chunk was so big they named it Edgar. Others looked at the path of the tsunami. Heusler's research focused on the landslide remnants that ended up underwater, looking at their size and characteristics. From the boat, he was working to map the ocean floor using technology called multi-beam bathymetry.
It's really neat because the topography on the ocean bottom just reveals itself as you go along so clearly. I mean, you could see, oh, here you're in flat fjord bottom. Here's this blocky stuff that clearly looks like landslide debris.
The goal was to understand the specifics of the landslide and wave to give scientists a better sense of how this kind of event happens. One of the paper's take-home messages is that global warming will make them more likely, since retreating glaciers can leave behind unstable slopes. In Alaska, scientists are thinking about how they should apply the paper's findings to management of public land and water. For Mike Loso, a geologist with Wrangell-St. Elias National Park who worked on the study, the issue is personal. He explains how by talking about Hoof Hill, the spot in the fjord where the water reached its highest point during the wave.
I spent my honeymoon with my wife on Hoof Hill, based out of sea kayaks.
Loso doesn't think it's appropriate to close places like the fjord where the tsunami happened, or other areas where scientists think that there could be risks of similar events, like in Glacier Bay National Park, which is popular with cruise ships. Scientists might not ever understand this type of tsunami well enough to issue warnings or to predict them, and they're not very likely to occur in places where there are people, Loso says. But he does think managers could give out more information about the risks of landslides and tsunamis, even if they're small.
An important role of the Park Service is to allow people to take those risks if they choose to, but we want to make sure they're well informed. So the better we understand these things, the better we can convey those hazards to the public.
and let them make good decisions, you know, whatever a good decision is for them.
The study is published in the journal Scientific Reports. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Brettwood Higman and documentary maker Bjorn Olsen stopped into the KBBI studios this week to sit down and talk about that expedition to Tanfjord and about a trip that Higman recently took to Gruink Lake in Kachemak Bay State Park for some landslide risk assessment.
Geologically speaking, that this story starts, you know, over 100 years ago, glacial retreat started going really rapidly in Icy Bay. And we think of it as Icy Bay today, but there are maps that were made in the 1890s, 1900, and they don't show a bay at all. It's just an ice face out in the Pacific. This bay has opened up really recently, and there's a bay that goes in kind of wedge-shaped, and it's got these fjords sticking off the back. If you go back into Tanfjord, one of these fjords at the back of Icy Bay, there's this Tindal Glacier, and the ice has dropped by somewhere around 1,500 feet there in vertical elevation. So it's gone way back horizontally, but also vertically. About 1991 or so, the ice reached roughly where it is now and kind of stabilized as it kind of rose up out of the water. And also around that time, we don't know exactly when, the mountain above that started moving. We can see in Landsat imagery and some topography data, we can see that the mountain was actively moving for at least two decades.
And when you say moving, what do you mean?
So it's cracking and it's shifting. So it actually, like, the upper part, the side of the mountain was moving down, and then the base of the mountain was bulging out. It's not behaving as a rigid chunk of mountain. If the ice had stayed there, if it hadn't retreated like that, then that ice would have been pressing up against that mountain, and that it wouldn't have started moving at all.
Which is, I think, one of the most intuitive terms that I learned on this project is the debuttressing, right? That it was held, it was buttressed, and now it's not buttressed anymore.
This is one of the connections to climate change, is you get this glacial retreat, and while the glacier's there, pushing out against the mountain and it's buttressing it, it's also actively eroding the bottom. It's making that classic U-shaped valley that we're all familiar with. And if you're in Yosemite, where the rock is really, really hard, it can be almost vertical on the sides. But in a place like many places, the rock's not that strong. So it can be U-shaped when it's full of ice, but you remove that ice and then it wants to be more V-shaped. And so that the sides collapse in. There ended up being three expeditions, and I was on two of them. Bjorn was on two.
Is it worth saying that it was kind of a real kind of seat of the pants NSF grant, right? That
was, yeah,
like,
it was.
Because the event, maybe to back up, it's like the event happened in October 2015, but then the whole expedition, the first expedition, was actually out there by May, right?
Yeah, we were actually out in April, in late April, I think, was the little recon expedition. And yeah, I guess if you were just to, like, just really quickly go through that whole sequence of events, you have two decades of this kind of shifting on the mountain. And then October of 2015 was quite rainy, not like amazingly rainy, but it was rainier than usual. And that elevates water tables and makes rock more inclined to break. And then there was a little earthquake, actually, not very big at all. Like, it was, I think, only a magnitude 4 or something, and it wasn't close. But those seismic waves arrived at the head of Tanfjord, and a few seconds later, the mountain gave way. And so the slide happened. And the way I picture it is kind of like if you see a tree covered in snow and all the snow falls off one side, the whole tree then swings back. The mountain did that. And so it bounced back as the slide started. And then the slide hit the bottom of the fjord and pushed the other direction. And it sets up this very long wavelength seismic wave. So it's like an earthquake seismic wave, but much longer period. There are folks, including our collaborators, Colin Stark and Jeroen Ekström, who have set up automated systems to detect weird seismic waves like this.
Using Alaska's existing seismic.
Yeah. Within a few hours of computers crunching on all of these seismic data streams coming in from all over the world, they said, oh, we think there was a huge landslide right here. And they were able to identify the location and the direction it was moving. They guessed it probably went into the water. 8 days later, there was a satellite photo, and they were able to see that the mountains along the side of the fjord, that it had stripped the forest from those mountains. The tsunami that was generated, so the landslide went into the water, the tsunami just completely stripped the forest from the up to sometimes hundreds of feet high along the side of the fjord.
And how did you gear up for this? I'm imagining a high-tech, low-tech mix here.
My particular geekery in this is looking at the deposits as these tsunami comes on shore. I wanted to do my science, but I volunteered, leaped in there to be the logistics person. We ended up with 30 people about were in the field at different points in time in these three different expeditions.
What did you bring out there with you?
For a lot of what I'm doing, I want a shovel and a pack raft and some sample bags and a camera. Bjorn was out there when they had the Gyre, a USGS research vessel in there.
The USGS was doing bathymetry, but then there's another team that had a little remote control, much smaller, the size of a pack raft almost, but a little remote control boat that was able to get the bathymetry of either the really shallow or the very dangerous, like near the glacier or where there is cliffs. And so we were able to really get a thorough mapping of the whole Tanfjord.
There have been various events like this, but the only one that's been really well documented is 1958 Latuya Bay. And that one is used when they're trying to model a landslide hitting the water and producing a tsunami. They pretty much have to go to Latuya Bay.
There's this kind of the social value side of this, that there are places in the world where there are communities downstream, which kind of then leads to understanding how this works.
I tend to come at this very much from a hazards perspective. Can we learn something from this event that then will help protect people? You know, and I've been in places where I've seen amazing natural event. That's the sort of thing I feel really privileged to have been able to see, even the fresh evidence of it. But then the human story is so tragic.
So you're in your pack raft with your sample bag and your shovel. What's in your sample bag and what are you doing with it?
What I was used to doing is going to earthquake tsunami deposits. So there's been an earthquake and a big tsunami comes in and brings sand from the beach, from the near shore, and leaves it in a layer. And so I take these little tiny few millimeter thick samples going all the way through the deposit. Well, here in Tan, we're looking at multiple meter thick deposits that have boulders in them. And, you know, my little tiny trowel starts looking rather silly. I did find some things that were small enough to fit in my sample bags. The thing we're looking at in those samples is we're looking at the distribution of sizes, grain size distributions, what we call that. But it's completely different than any tsunami deposits I'd ever worked on. Pretty exciting. If you like looking at sand and gravel and boulders.
Well, I do like looking at sand and gravel and boulders. How do you represent that as data?
In this case, we're looking at histograms, and it's a graph where you have like a bell curve. Typically, if you see a bell curve, you're probably looking at a histogram. And so that's one of the ways that I start to try to see what do these look like on more than a trivial level.
Then there's other components too. So you had your specialty, mm-hmm. but then there are other people that were accurately mapping how the tsunami moved down the fjord. And that's kind of a whole other kind of almost component. Like everybody's coming together with their piece of the puzzle.
That must be quite a meeting when everybody's got their data and they're ready to represent it and you all need to cooperate.
And even in the field, from my perspective, mm-hmm. it was such a neat time to be a fly on the wall. You know, when everybody's coming together at the end of the day and kind of talking about what they saw and how it fits or either doesn't fit with somebody else's, you know, idea.
And it was definitely one of the things I wanted to see when we were in the field. And I felt like it did kind of happen. Some of these people had never met each other before, never worked together. They really are kind of doing different science.
Right.
Without this event to glue it together, they aren't necessarily related. So to make that time to sit down and really have some discussions, we're all in the field, let's take the time to have those conversations.
Bjorn, were you recording these conversations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I kind of had two roles. The one that I was most solemn about was being documentarian, and then the other was the logistics side of it. It was always expanding in my mind as I was there, like, what kind of story am I going to tell? Because for me, what's important, how do you compress all of this incredible technical information into something that somebody can watch that has no background information and in 10 minutes, 15 minutes kind of understand? Oftentimes what I would do is just leave the camera rolling when it was those kind of evening discussions. The lion's share of it didn't end up in the final film, but it's neat to have this kind of like lasting record. I would have to pick. So sometimes I would go with Higg when he's digging a trench and follow him. And sometimes I was with the surveyors who were trying to track exactly where the tsunami went.
What are some of the other teams that were there?
Well, so there's the landslide specialist. The surveyors is kind of a generic term for it, but
tsunami modelers, really. They're trying to have data that they can compare to their computer models.
And then on the second expedition, there was below sea level mapping.
Both bathymetry and also the subsurface or the subfloor mapping. What was the name of that device? Pinger or something. I don't know.
Bubble pinger?
I don't think that's it. They're seismic profilers that let you see through the seafloor. And so they can see the blocks of landslide blocks that have been buried by loose mud on top of the landslide, things like that, underneath the seafloor.
people can see a movie.
It's about
of
a 15 minute
project.
Of this project. Yep. It's the Ground Truth Trekking Vimeo channel.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's called Icy Bay Mega Tsunami. One of the things I think was very unique about it, I heard this from several of the different scientists, is that how fortunate it was that there's this, you know, massive landslide, which created this enormous tsunami in a place where no one got hurt, and that they were able to go out and study it so soon after the event and really get good data. Whereas if it had been a year or two later, you know, some of it would have eroded or things would be growing. So they got a lot of information.
It's got great interviews in it with the scientists. That's a big component of it. And that's one of the things I really enjoyed about it.
I'd like to move on to talk to you about just coming back from Gruink Lake.
Yeah, so the reason to look at something like Tan is because it's a very remote location, but there are similar setups in various places in Alaska. People worry about Glacier Bay is one of the ones. One is right here, and actually it looks like it might be in the world one of the most dramatic examples of this situation is right here at Gruink Lake. In Gruink.
And when you say this example, you mean recently deglaciated, steep, unstable hill slope, right?
Yeah, you just start stacking up all these risk factors. I mean, you have to have, obviously you have to have the mountain, the steep mountain there, and then deglaciation in Gruink Lake has been quite rapid. If you go back even to 1950 or 1940, something like that, there was basically almost no lake there at all. And now it's quite large. The rate that the glacier goes away. Another one is permafrost melting. I increasingly think that there is permafrost in the ridge, Alpine Ridge above Gruink Lake, that's melting.
I think it's worth saying, you know, because I think a lot of people in Alaska only ever think of permafrost as like a tundra phenomena.
Right. Yeah, this is alpine permafrost. So it's basically the mountain sticks up enough that the climate is colder up there. That's why different vegetation and stuff grows on top of the mountain. And even in places where you're far from the huge expanses of permafrost up in the Arctic, you can have permafrost holding the mountains together. And ice, you know, is a lot stronger than water in order to hold your mountain together. So that's basically what we're talking about, is that the ice is actually part of the strength of the mountain. And it has been maybe for hundreds of years or even longer, depending. Now it's melting and the mountain is weakening and more likely to fail. The lake is pushing 500 feet deep in places.
Means that you can have an enormous wave.
Yeah, when you drop a mountainside into a body of water, if there's not much water there, the landslide pretty much just behaves as a landslide. And yes, that water will move around, but it needs some depth of water in order to really generate a big wave.
The one that happened in the 60s was big enough to go entirely over the outwash plain and make a splash into Kachemak Bay.
So in 1967, there was a landslide into Gruink Lake, which at that time was much smaller than what it is today. And the landslide came down onto the toe of the glacier, went into the lake, and it generated a 60-meter high tsunami and covered most of the outwash plain, I believe. If the setup was there for it to happen once, it may well happen again. Weakens the mountain as a whole, and the areas adjacent to that can be more vulnerable. It hadn't totally clicked for me until I got involved with this Tan event, and I was like, oh, I see.
Well, we try every month to point out one opportunity at least for citizen science on the show.
Oh, great. Well, one thing, since you just brought that up, like with Gruink, there is a very, if you're ever up at Gruink, any of the listeners are ever up at Gruink, and you see any kind of rockfall, and like this could be just a single boulder rolling down the mountain, if you can note where it came from, whether you take a picture and like then remember in your mind and email me, like where you put a big red X on the picture, or you just describe it as best you can, or tell just where the rock hit the water, anything about where those landslides are happening is really valuable. Because when you have a situation like this, I talked about in Tan the way that the mountain was moving for a long time prior, there's looks like Gruink has the mountain there is probably moving too. We haven't measured that yet, but there are cracks and such up high that look like they are actively moving. When that happens, the edge of the part that is moving, often there are small slides. If we can get people to tell us about where those little slides are happening, then that'll help us figure out where might the mountain fail. And then another layer to that is, if you see one of those slides and then you see another one, then you might want to just leave, like, because...
Well, that's why I wanted to bring up risk assessment.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a campsite right on the beach, a designated campsite on the beach in Gruink Lake. And it's kind of like in a corner of the lake if you look at the map. And I've just yesterday got some model results. And you see that even a small tsunami will tend to concentrate a bit of the wave into that corner. If you were there just visiting and you saw something happen, if it wasn't gigantic, if it was smaller than what happened in 67, you're probably going to escape it. You just run up the trail, and like it actually, it doesn't rise real steeply, but it rises enough to get you out of the where the wave had come. But if you're asleep in your tent, that's just a lot more hours. It is just hard to get yourself going if you're, you know, laying in bed. You have to make that decision. I just heard a big noise. What does that mean? Should I jump out of bed and run up the trail in my skivvies? I would just not camp at that campground is my take on it anyway.
And that's the recommendation you made to the Parks Department
yesterday? That is one of the recommendations I made, yeah. Sometimes there's an earthquake and then I would say, yeah, that's maybe the couple days after that happens. That's probably a good couple days to just to not be in that valley. The risk is probably substantially elevated. If it's just been an incredibly rainy time, you know, it's probably not the best time either, you know. The ideal is that we could say most of the time the risk is low. It's, you know, on par with something that hasn't happened for half a century, but that we have some tools, things like watching for small landslides, but also maybe technical tools with monitoring that we could say, this month the mountain is accelerating. We need to at least evaluate it more and maybe evacuate the valley. But in general, that is a pretty amazing place, both seeing evidence of the 67. So 1967, this landslide and tsunami that happened there, like even that bit of trail that goes through the flats just before you reach the beach at Gruink Lake, you'll see giant boulders and you'll see scour marks around them. And those boulders, we don't know how much they were transported, but they probably were transported by the tsunami and they definitely had the tsunami flow going around them and scouring them. You'll see some of these sorted boulder deposits. You start looking around, you'll see patches of small boulders that are all really consistent in size, just like what I was talking about in Tan. And that is a pretty neat thing where you can go out as, I mean, this is, we haven't even really gotten around to properly documenting it at Gruink. It is a science that hasn't really been done yet, and you as an individual can go see this. And maybe most dramatic is to go up Alpine Ridge and poke around and see some of the different cracks and different features up there. You know, there's the little lake that you go by. If you go up Alpine Ridge, there's a lake that'll be, most people, the way they walk, it'll be on your left as you go, just kind of are getting out of the brush. And that lake is strangely drained, and not drained dry in this case. It's drained a bit. That's a question. Where is the water draining? Like, how does it have a drain out the bottom of it? It's kind of on this big flat ridge. And we wonder, well, are there some cracks even in way back in that area? So there are a lot of questions. And just by hiking around there, you could start to get a sense of that. And I think this is really exciting stuff. And it's amazing to see kind of geology in action like that.
That is Brett Wood Higman of Seldovia and Bjorn Olson of Homer. You can find a link to the study that they just published by going to groundtruthtrekking.org. Getting growers, distributors, and consumers of local food on the same page is Kyra Wagner's chief pursuit. To that end, she collects data and organizes numbers and people. Wagner came by the station to share a presentation she makes all over the peninsula about what it takes to connect local growers to local consumers.
I have worked for about the last decade really focused on food issues in our community. I integrated it into my work with Sustainable Homer, and now I am the district manager for Homer Soil and Water, and I get the chance to work with farmers all around the peninsula as well as through the state. I am concerned with food security as a community. You grow your food, you distribute your food, you buy, you sell, and you can maintain a food system. And there are different sections of the food system. The supply and demand side, that's your production and your consumption. And so I'll talk a little bit about that, but there's also the infrastructure that supports both of those. So I will talk about the processing that supports the production and the purchasing power that supports the demand side. First of all, let's talk about production. Many people may think that we have lots of farmers around here. If you look at the Food Hub website, you'll just see lists and icons of different farmers in the community, different companies around the peninsula. So how many farmers do we have? We have a population of about 12,000 people in our area. How many farmers do we need? Well, I'm going to talk first about this interesting number, less than 1%. Less than 1% is how many farmers we have in the nation as a whole. And the reason I know that is because the U.S. Census does not put farming down any longer as a profession. If you are to fill out your profession on the census, you won't see farming because they don't put those small-scale jobs down. So even though we consider ourselves a country built on agriculture, we have less than 1% farmers in our population. What that means is that our food system has gotten monopolized and shrunk down into the hands of a very few people that run very large farms and have corporate centers that function more as a factory farm rather than a cute little idealistic farm like we'd love to think that we have in our country. So what about our area? What does that mean for us? It means that we have a few brave, enduring, idealistic, and hardy souls who are our local farmers here. I would say that there are approximately 40 producers in the area. I'm talking, of course, about producers who grow food, but also sell food, make it part of our community food system. I would say about 20 of those sell regularly, consistently, and consider farming an identity for themselves. And most of those folks farm on an acre or less. We are looking at quality versus quantity here. We have a few dedicated farmers who are growing Alaska grown. Alaska grown, there's nothing better. Don't try and compare it to organic. It doesn't matter to me if a farmer isn't 100% USDA organic in Alaska. The fact is it costs a ton of money to get certified organic. We would have to fly up certifiers. That may change, get our own certifiers here. But even if we have certifiers here, we have to bring in the additives that we'd add to our soil that would have to be OMRI listed to be a USDA organic certified farmer. And the fact is, we don't have the kind of threats and problems that the lower 48 has. Farming in the lower 48 is like warfare with pests. So herbicides and pesticides, even under organic, the organic label does allow various kinds of herbicides and pesticides. Compared to what we're seeing with the organic in the lower 48 Alaska grown, we have Alaska soils, which are new and young and rich, easily added to with local fish and local additives like kelp meal that can really improve our soils, give us amazing micronutrients and nutrients that no longer exist in the soils in the lower 48. So that's what we have for production. Let's go to processing now, though, because this is the part of infrastructure that goes to support our farmers. In Homer, we have one facility that has a commercial DEC-approved Hobart steamer for blanching 3 to 5 pounds of produce at a time, multiple commercial vacuum sealers with varied size bags available, a small DEC-approved kitchen with a stove, coolers, and oven, 1,000-plus commercial canner, and ample freezer space for flash freezing, 2 walk-in refrigerators, and limited display freezer space in their store. That description is Coal Point Trading. Nancy Hillstrand of Coal Point did get certified for processing vegetables at her facility, not just fish. No matter how divine that whole system sounds, it doesn't get utilized very often by our small-scale farmers. Another one of the issues, as far as infrastructure goes, is the regulations. Our meat producers have to go to a place that is specifically USDA certified for processing meat. So they have to go all the way with their cows up to Palmer to get them butchered and packaged if they want to sell them commercially. That's why in town here you usually see the local ranchers selling a whole cow or a half a cow, because they're selling you the cow to take care of yourself, not to be sold in parts and pieces through a grocery store. This makes it a lot more difficult for them to get our local meat out into the hands of local people who can't afford to necessarily buy a whole cow or a half a cow at a time. There's also an issue with milk. We do have people who produce milk products here, but there are a lot of regulations that stand in the way of making that easy. Of course, for health benefits, everybody wants their milk pasteurized. Well, if you want to sell raw milk in the state, you have to dye it pink if you're going to be legal. The only legal way to sell raw milk is to dye it pink and call it pet food. If you otherwise want to sell raw milk on a commercial basis, you have to individually meet with every consumer, and they have to buy a cow or goat share So they own part of the goat, and then you are just giving them a portion of the milk they deserve from their goat or their cow. Let's go from the processing, though, to the purchasing. We have roadside stands, we have farmers markets, we have CSAs. It's a box that the consumer orders directly from the farmer. Farmers market, you can go weekly and you get to also see your farmer. Same story at the farm stand. The food hub is an online farmers market, so it doesn't have the face-to-face aspect specifically, but you do get to go on at the alaskafoodhub.org. You can order whatever our local producers have posted that week. The infrastructure for purchasing food in Homer is much more advanced than a lot of areas. We definitely have figured that part out. At Homer Soil and Water, we're doing a survey of the different producers in town as well as the different restaurants. What do they consume? What do they produce? An example here with baby greens and lettuces, we have one producer. This is a small-scale producer, has maybe a high tunnel, can produce 300 pounds a season, and that's going to be their production for the year. Producer number two, a little bit larger scale, is going to be producing 2,300 heads of lettuce. So that's 2,300 to 3,400 pounds of lettuce. Now the buyer can use 30 pounds a week, 120 pounds a month, comes to about 1,440 pounds a year. That is less need than the producers can produce during the time of the year that they produce it, but they don't go all year long. It makes it so that the buyers have plenty of supply at certain times of the year and not enough at other times of the year. Let's use the example of zucchini. Our producer number one produces 150 pounds a season. The buyer can use 22 pounds a week, 80 pounds a month, 1,056 pounds a year. So they're going to be using a lot more every year than the producer grows. And maybe there's a portion of the season that the producer could actually meet the buyer's needs. Potatoes, easy to grow. Therefore, a lot of people grow them. So nobody necessarily grows them in large scale quantity. Let's say that our producers grow between 200 to 300 pounds a year. A buyer can use 200 pounds a month. This means that the potatoes demand isn't going to get met by our producers at almost any scale. So here are some numbers from the Homer Farmers Markets EBT transactions. Now, the electronic transactions at the farmers market is when you don't have any cash and you need to use a credit card. You can go up to the front desk and they can swipe your card and they'll give you market tokens. The market tokens can only be spent at the market. In 2011, when the project started, about $7,900 was swiped through that credit card machine. But in 2016, $76,000 was swiped through that credit card machine. Of course, this is only measuring the people who brought their credit cards and aren't paying with cash. This also is an indicator of our SNAP benefits program. SNAP is the form of food stamps that we use now, a credit card that can be swiped. And in 2011, $1,100 was swiped on the SNAP benefits card. And at its peak in 2013, $4,800 was spent. It wasn't long after this that the SNAP program doubling benefits was canceled by the state. And so after that, we saw numbers go down. But as far as growth in the food hub, we've also been able to mark that. In Homer, in 2016, $22,000 was spent on the food hub. And in 2017, almost $25,000 was spent on the food hub. And that's just people ordering straight up from the farmers in our community. In Soldotna, the first year in 2016, they had $5,376 worth of sales in Soldotna. The next year, the food hub opened it up so that farmers from Homer could also sell in Soldotna. So increased the variety that they were offering there, and they increased their sales by 83%. They shot up to $9,800 worth of sales in Soldotna. We also tried to run a food hub location in Anchorage in 2017, and that brought in about $5,500. The growth each year has been increasing for each site that we've done. The total 2017 sales in the Alaska Food Hub was over $40,000. You could say that looking at the numbers for the food hub, there was a 98% growth for the food hub between 2016 and 2017. So our demand is definitely there. Our production is modest but high quality. Getting our processing in gear, getting our purchasing systems in gear have been a local focus for a long time, and our systems are improving all the time. Being able to get our production and our demand to match is where we're going to have the balancing act. Right now, at the end of the summer, we have production from our small-scale farmers in intense numbers. So we have lots of cabbage and zucchini and cauliflower and broccoli and things that they have planted and grown all summer, but the harvest is now. A lot of our consumers, they go to the farmer's market early in the summer and they don't see much, and so they don't develop a habit of going to the farmer's market. But now, when there's tons of food, we need everybody going down to the farmer's market and or ordering on the Alaska Food Hub to utilize the local food that is being developed. Homer Soil and Water is doing a study right now, a local food systems survey, where we have questions going out to producers as well as farmers, asking them what they grow, how they grow it, what kind of labor problems they have, all kinds of issues about production to see where we can support them and what they do, what their acreage is, how much, what they produce, all those kind of things. Then we're also talking with the consumer side, the demand side, asking the restaurants, how much do you use? What do you use? How much more would you be willing to pay for it? We're also going to include things like the store, the senior center, hospital, the schools as well, the borough, finding out what all of those needs are and what their restrictions are and requirements are so that we can then inform the producers and find out how to make that match. It will be on the Homer Soil and Water webpage when it's completed. I love to eat, but I also love the community that is created when you are dealing with people that are working in the dirt and people that are eating healthy, and all aspects of food production make for a stronger, healthier community. There's no reason not to work on this. And over 95%, some statistics say, of our food is ordered from the lower 48. If we can become more resilient in our own communities, grow our own food, we know it's going to be fresher. We know it's going to be more nutritious. We know it's going to be healthier. And we know that the people who are creating it, whether it's us or someone else, are going to be working outside, working in the dirt, taking advantage of living here in Alaska to do something amazing to integrate into the community. There's not really any negatives. One of the infrastructure aspects for our producers that is lacking is any kind of collaborative storage. So if we had some kind of storage facility, like a community root cellar or a wholesaler who had a huge root cellar or refrigeration system, then our farmers could put together, amalgamate all of their production, and it could therefore meet not only a large restaurant's demands, but maybe also that large restaurant demand over a period of time. A lot of our grocery store stuff comes to us and it's weeks old. We're getting stuff that's really fresh. So if we put it overnight or even for a week in a refrigerator, it's still going to be better.
Growers and buyers of local produce can contact Kyra Wagner and participate in the survey by going to the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District homepage at homerswcd.org. On last month's episode of Catch a Mac Science, we invited you to take part in Beluga's Count, organized by NOAA Fisheries Alaska. Next, you'll hear from Verena Gill from NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region in Anchorage, who is an organizer of Beluga's Count. Also, Chris Holdereed from NOAA's Kositsnebé Lab, and Jill Burnham, Kachemak Bay Campus of Kenai Peninsula College student. KPC Professor Debbie Tobin begins the discussion with a recap of last Saturday's second annual NOAA's Beluga's Count. There were 14 counting stations in Cook Inlet. Professor Tobin and her students headed north to take part.
last Saturday, Mark Weber, who's with the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, and I, who co-teach a marine mammal biology class here at the college, took our students. And so we were able to locate belugas on our way up on Friday and then participate in belugas count on Saturday and then also locate belugas again on our way back on Sunday. We found at our station, we had two groups of belugas that went by, one of three and another of two. And though we had not quite as many belugas sightings, we had lots of visitors. So this was an important event for citizen science. And we had 348 visitors stop by Windy Corner, where we manned a station for the NOAA Belugas Count event, looking for visitors and looking for belugas and counting both.
And that was Windy Corner in Anchorage?
Yes, in Turnagain Arm.
And Verena Gill, where were you for this count?
I was organizing the event, so I was in a few different places as the day progressed. I started out at Point Warren's off the beginning of the day at 10 o'clock when the station opened, but I moved around.
And can you tell me a little bit of what the day was like? Are you compiling the numbers?
So there were 100 beluga sightings throughout South Central Alaska. That doesn't mean 100 individual belugas, because, you know, some of the belugas, they do move down the arm with the incoming tide and out with the outgoing tide. But there was 100 sightings that range from the Homer Station all the way up to Palmer and the Goose Bay Station. And last year we had 255 sightings, so quite a bit fewer sightings than last year. It doesn't mean there are less belugas, because, again, this isn't trying to estimate abundance. It's just looking at distribution, presence, and absence, and they may have chosen to be in other places this year. The station with the most beluga sightings was the Bird Point Station along Turnagain Arm, and they had 22 sightings, but particularly exciting were the 14 belugas that were seen at the Kenai Station going up the Kenai River. They were up the river a number of hours, and then they came back down. So that was one of the more interesting sightings, and that was a new station this year.
And Verena, what do you do with this data now?
So this is the second year, and all of the sightings into a database, into a portal that is publicly accessible, so people can look at this particular data set and include this belugas count. More importantly, this is just the beginning of, I hope, many, many, many years of this project. And as time goes on, we hope to be able to build a real good picture of what belugas are doing in September in South Central Alaska. Where are they? How many calves are there? Where are they feeding? Over time, I think that will give us an idea. This is kind of baseline. It's not going to tell us the number of belugas. We have to use a different kind of methodology for that. We fly aerial surveys to collect what we call abundance. That's the number of animals in Cook Inlet. But this looks at distribution. Where are they? And when are they there?
How many people were counting?
I'll give you another statistic, because I'm a biologist and that's what we like to do, give you statistics. We had 2,079 people, so over 2,000 people in attendance for belugas count in South Central Alaska, again from the Homer Station up to Palmer. And then we had partners. We had four aquarium that were our partners, and they had sister events at their particular facilities. And those numbers are starting to trickle in, but I'll just give you one from Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, where they live-streamed into us, where we had our festival at the zoo in the afternoon on Saturday. But they also had their own particular activity down there at Shedd, and they had 10,903 people. So almost 11,000 people came to Shedd to celebrate Belugas Count Day all the way in Chicago.
So if you have time, can you stay on the line while I talk to Chris? And if you have something to add, you feel free to jump in.
Certainly.
Okay, stand by. Chris Holderide, I saw you at the Homer Station, you and Donna Adderhold. Sadly, no belugas.
No belugas, and we weren't expecting to see them. And Verena has highlighted the other kind of part of this event, which is outreach and giving people information about where to find belugas. Where are they in the inlet typically, but also, you know, how do you spot them? Because they're not the easiest whales to see. You know, you see that little kind of white hump, and it's not like the flash of a humpback tail or something like that. So it might be a little bit more subtle to see. But I think once people recognize that, we might realize, oh, we get more sightings than you might imagine. And so one of the things I realized when I was doing the event up in the arm last year was that you can increase your chances of seeing belugas as you drive to or from Anchorage simply by when you go, what time of tide you go, right? If you're a couple hours either side of the high tide, you have a much better chance of seeing them. And, you know, it's an easy thing to know, but I didn't know it before I did this, right? It was very handy. And we weren't expecting them to see belugas in Homer, but we wanted to pass out information and also take a look, because if you don't look, you don't know. And one of the really interesting things that happened was one of the folks that came up to help us watch for the 3 hours we were out there said, hey, I know some folks who saw belugas just below their place in Miller's Landing this summer. So in Kachemak Bay. Whoa, that's huge. Follow up on that. But, you know, part of this is communication, and maybe people have seen them in the bay. They wouldn't be common. We haven't heard of that in quite a while. Maybe partially because we're not looking as much. You know, so some of this is, hey, let's pay attention, let's look, let's, you know, draw in the wide variety of people who are out there on the water to keep an eye out, you know, and maybe then we realize they're in more places than we thought.
Well, it sounds like Kenai is a component to this story. Debbie?
Yeah, I just wanted to also add and ask Chris to chime in too. I know some other species besides belugas, which are also important, were seen. For example, we also saw harbor seals in our area, and we know that some of the other stations, like in Tyonek, saw harbor porpoises, which again are very difficult to see, but it's incredibly important to know that they're there. So that public outreach event and the education overall, the citizen science component, getting people to know what to look for and then how to follow up and report those data. So at Chris, at your station here in Homer, what else did you guys see?
We were there 10 to 1 at the Baycrest Overlook and saw 4 humpback whales, a whole bunch of seabirds, a couple dozen otters probably over the course of that time, which was really fun. And it's also typically a place where you might see seals hauling out. We didn't see them on Saturday, but you can if you look at the rocks down there.
Jill Burnham, were you at Windy Corner?
I was a part of the Semester by the Bay program, which happens every fall. There's a focus on marine science, and students come from all over the country to study with Debbie and her team, and we get to do incredible things like this field trip. We spent 3 days, you know, really patiently looking for and seeing a lot of belugas. We saw 20 belugas on our first day there, which was incredibly exciting, and I'd never seen one in the wild before. But it's a really fantastic program. We also got to go to Northwest Glacier 2 weeks ago to see some wonderful wildlife there.
So the Kenai Station, how exciting, they saw 14. And Verena can certainly chime in more about some of the studies recently that have found beluga whales in the Kenai River more often and at different times of the year than we realized they were using that area. But somebody at the station who this year for belugas count was Allison Gardell. She's our new biology professor at the Kenai River campus of KPC UAA. Mark and I have taken our students to the Kenai River in the past looking for belugas and working with some folks who regularly look for belugas and do photo ID work there. But now with Allison at the Kenai River campus, hopefully we'll start more of a collaborative joint effort to monitor for beluga whales in the Kenai River.
This is Verena in Anchorage. Another one of the aims of Belugas Count this year was to garner people interested in being citizen scientists year-round looking for belugas. We wanted to harness some of that wonderful energy from the event, and so we had people sign up if they were interested in year-round monitoring certain rivers. One of the focuses would be on Kenai. We would love to have people out there every weekend, if possible, or certain evenings, but on a regular, systematic basis in the Kenai from about March when they start using the river. They use it, we found, from about March to May, and then they tend to all move up to the Susitna Flat area and then come back down to the Kenai in the fall. But we would love to have people on a regular basis monitoring Kenai River for us so that we can get a better handle on how many are using the river, who they are. By taking photos, you can actually individually identify belugas by the markings on their back, and there's a photo ID project that is doing that. They actually have a website. If you go to cookinletbelugas.org, you'll be able to see some of the whales on there that have been individually identified and named. People can take photos. We can identify which particular whales are using the river and help us get a better understanding on the Kenai Peninsula.
So did you say cookinletbelugas.org? Submit photos they've taken for ID.
That will just take you to the website where you can submit, if you see photographs or actually see belugas, you can submit sightings there and it will come to us.
One of the things that, you know, we weren't sure the Homer site, how many people might stop by, because, you know, people aren't necessarily looking for belugas in Kachemak Bay. And it was great. We had, you know, a total of 6 people that were counting, you know, sort of more formally counting. And we had about 25 people stop by who were interested in the information and took a peek. And most of them got to see a humpback as well. So, yeah, it was really a great day.
So that's Chris Holdereed. You were down here in Homer. Jill Burnham, you were on the other end of the inlet.
One of the most exciting things to me was really seeing how many people, over 300 people, stopped by, and just watching their interest build as we talked, and that unifying experience. It seems so silly, but you all see a whale together, and then there's this big, huge celebration with people you didn't previously know. But just to see how eager people are to talk about wildlife and nature and science, and they would pick up tidbits of information and pass it along to their friends, and it just seemed like a really healthy way to be in the world and in the day.
Can you talk a little bit about your science education at KPC? When did you start? What are you working toward that got you in marine science? Or is it just lifelong learning for you?
No, it was a reboot of my life. I worked for the Los Angeles Opera for 15 years. And 3 years ago, my husband and children and I moved up here. And there's no opera employment in Homer. And it was clear to me. I've always been engaged in community projects as a professional. And science just is so healthy and strong in this community and in Homer and in the Bay, that it was clear to me I had to become conversant in science if I wanted to have a meaningful relationship with the community organizations here that were interesting to me. So I decided to go back and finish my degree, and I took one class from Debbie, and as I like to say, she just ripped my heart out of my chest and gave it to science, and that was it. Just like I'm finding that I'm really, really, really in love with everything biology. It's been one of the most exciting things I've ever done, and to be able to get a four-year degree from this campus is really fantastic.
I just wanted to add that we had several people we met during the Belugas Count event on Saturday, who then when we were looking again on Sunday, we ran into several of those folks who were out there for a second day doing it again. Nice. And several folks who told us, which I haven't told Verena yet either, that after they left our station, they went to the station just west of us where we don't have a monitoring group. This particular man and another gentleman on his bicycle were able to see 10 belugas there. So at our windy corner, we saw 5 over the course of those 3 hours, and they, just stopping by and looking for a little while, not too far at all from where we were at, saw 10 belugas right there. And then again, those folks were out the next day doing it all over again because they were so excited about it.
Well, thank you, Professor Debbie Bogie Tobin from UAA's Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College here in Homer. Also from Kachemak Bay campus, Jill Burnham. And thank you, Chris Holderreed from the NOAA Kasitsna Bay Lab. Also on the phone from Anchorage, thanks, Verena Gill from NOAA Fisheries Alaska Region in Anchorage.
You're very welcome. I just say keep an eye on for Belugas Count 2019 because it's going to happen.
For more information about the count, about the photo IDs for belugas, and about how you can volunteer to participate in the next Belugas Count, type Cook Inlet Belugas Count into your favorite search engine or social media platform. You also heard from Nat Herz from Alaska's Energy Desk and from Brettwood Higman and Bjorn Olson representing Ground Truth Trekking, and from Kyra Wagner from the Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Our theme song is The Supreme Beings of Leisure, mixed with Deep Voices recordings of humpback blue and right whales, produced by Dr. Roger Payne. And you heard incidental music from Congo Sanchez and Mike Dillon. You can access this program or any of the 6 other episodes of Kachemak Science by going to kbbi.org. This show is produced at KBBI Homer, Alaska, where the sound meets the sea. Thanks for listening. Kachemak Science will be back in 4 weeks with more discussions, presentations, and reviews in the lab, in the classroom, and in the field. We share the data from local science by local scientists.